Meeting is now being recorded.
Hello and welcome to Jurisdiction Subgroup Meeting Number 24 of the Workstream 2 of CCWG Accountability, March 28, 2017, at 1900 UTC. I'm Greg Chatton, co-rapporteur, and we'll begin with a brief review of the agenda, which is in front of you. After a couple of moments of administration, we'll move on to an update on the questionnaire, which is currently out for responses until mid-April, and then to the main event of today's call, the review of ICANN's litigations. And we are blessed with the presence of Mathieu Vail, who will review the cases he reviewed and summarize for the group. So without further ado, are there any questions on the agenda or any items to be put up now for AOB? If there are no objections, we'll move on to item three, administration. First, I'll ask if there are any changes to statements of interest. Seeing none, I'll also ask if there is anybody who is only on the audio bridge to identify themselves. Appears we have no one only on audio. Finally, I'll ask for the person with the phone number ending in 5316 to identify themselves, unless that is, in fact, their name and they've changed their name into a number. If numbers were as easy to remember as names, we probably wouldn't even be here. Phil Corwin is 5316. In any case, the questions to ICANN Legal are currently in ICANN's Legal's hands. I've been told that we should have an ETA for a response from ICANN Legal fairly shortly. I don't have an exact ETA for the ETA yet, but I will hopefully at least have an ETA for the ETA, and soon after that, an ETA for the actual responses. Let us move on now, unless there are any questions about that, to item four. Questionnaire update. Update on current responses is that there are no new responses since last week. But we still have a good amount of time for responses to come in. April 17th is the deadline. As before, I'll remind all members of this group to publicize the existence of the questionnaire in any other groups or lists relating in any way to the Internet in which they participate so that we get the widest possible distribution and potential responses in. Hopefully following Copenhagen, members of the GAC and others who learned more about this in Copenhagen and had a chance to discuss it amongst themselves will also have publicized it within their communities. And I expect that, as is typical in any ICANN exercise, we will get a flurry of responses close to and on the 17th of April. Finally, I'll encourage all of you to respond directly to the questionnaire as well. The questionnaire review and evaluation team, has been assembled. I don't have the exact list, but it was posted last week, and a couple of other people came up in addition and named themselves as either having already volunteered or newly volunteered. To remind everyone, the group is going to review the new responses when there are some and respond to the subgroup on those responses and status, and is also supposed to work on proposing an evaluation framework for the responses which framework will be approved by the full subgroup. We're going to create a mailing list for this group. It'll be a usual open type ICANN email list. Just want to keep the back and forth from getting swamping the main jurisdiction list, but it'll be visible to all. And we're going to do a doodle poll shortly among the group members to schedule a call and to get started on the particularly the evaluation framework so that we have that fully in place before the final flurry of expected responses. Any questions on the questionnaire? I see Christopher Wilkinson with a question. Could staff please recall where are the translations of the questionnaire? I believe they are on the same wiki page as the English language questionnaire as well. I see Christopher also has his hand up. Please go ahead, Christopher.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Thank you, Greg. Just to recall, I think that in an earlier mail, I did volunteer to join the evaluation group, and I think my name has not made it to the list. So maybe that could be corrected. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. I'll ask staff to add you to the list and to circulate an updated list to the full mail list, just so that everyone can see who is in the QRET, Questionnaire Review and Evaluation Team, possibly the worst acronym in ICANN history. Anything else on questionnaires? Seeing none, I'll move on to the next. Mathieu suggests merely calling the team Q. That seems very James Bondian, should elevate it considerably. Moving on to the review of ICANN's past and current litigation, we'll skip over A and B for the moment because I'd like to get to really the main event, make sure we have enough time to discuss summaries of cases themselves. The sign-up sheet looks pretty much as it did last week, except that I signed up for a couple of cases. And perhaps someone else has in the very recent past. If we have time, we will discuss the summary sheet because I think it could still use some improvements in regard to capturing things that are of the most interest to this group, aside from just the kind of the facts or the vital statistics of the case. We need more things that will kind of highlight for discussion what the jurisdiction affects or lack thereof were of these cases. So I'm going to turn over the microphone to Mathieu and let him go into the summaries. Staff should have the summaries. They've been circulated previously, and I just circulated them one more time in the last few minutes. So I will turn it over to Mathieu. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Mathieu Vey speaking. So the good thing in signing up first on this list was that I got to pick the most interesting cases, and at least it was very educational for me to review a number of these, and including this one in front of you, which is the VeriSign case, VeriSign versus ICANN, which actually, the plaintiff was VeriSign, defendant was ICANN, but also about 50 John Does. And it took place in several stages, but started in the Central District of California, the Court of Appeals, California Superior Court, and a little arbitration on in front of the International Chamber of Commerce. John Doe, yeah. We would say Dupont, probably, in French. So the case started in February 2004, ended in December 2006, and it was basically VeriSign arguing that ICANN had violated the antitrust laws, Sherman Act, if I'm not mistaken, had breached its contract with VeriSign and interfered with contractual relations between VeriSign and other parties. The issue at stake was that ICANN's decisions to not allow VeriSign to roll out new services such as SiteFinder were creating restrictions and delays to VeriSign's ability to offer services, and that ICANN would be assuming regulatory power and over VeriSign business. So that was kind of a big case. I think some people refer to it as the VeriSign Wars in ICANN's history. And it was, the outcome was that the claim was dismissed in September 2004. There was an appeal, and then at some point there was a settlement which led to the case being dismissed in December 2006. There was no challenge of jurisdiction. There was preliminary relief requested but not granted. And if we think of the impact on the operation of ICANN's policies, there might have been an impact had the plaintiff's claims been granted, because it would have challenged ICANN's ability to enforce its contracts. Whether it's for right or bad is not for us to say at this point, but at least it was clearly challenging ICANN's way of enforcing contracts. And it's important to note that there were a number of constituencies actually putting pressure on ICANN to act this way. It was not just ICANN's board on its own. And, of course, I think it's important to remind ourselves as well that at the time there was no specific policy in place to define what additional services were about, and ICANN actually put up RCEP after that. So, very interesting case overall. I think from our jurisdiction point of view, what's interesting is that it was an antitrust claim. It could probably have been filed had VeriSign been a European company, for instance. It could probably there might have been a case for doing an antitrust claim against ICANN in Europe as well, so that would be a potential question. That's one of the questions we've actually asked the lawyers. But this one was definitely in California, with everyone being U.S. players. Greg, I don't know whether that's the type of summary you expect and how you want to lead the conversation on this. Maybe if there's any inaccuracy in my recollection.
I think that's a very helpful start. I think that I see on the summary, at least we have on the screen, and maybe there's a more recent one than this elsewhere. The choice of law / governing law row is blank.
Yes.
Do you recall what it was, in fact?
So that's the question in the summary that, not being a lawyer, I don't feel comfortable actually filling out. Because I sometimes get lost in this, what does choice of law, governing law mean? So I might require some help filling in.
Thank you, Matthew. I have not looked at the case, but looking at the summary, I can see that if there was an attempt to apply the Sherman Act antitrust laws, that's U.S. federal antitrust law. And then breach of contract and interference with contractual relations would be state law claims, typically. In the absence of a mention otherwise, and seeing that there was, you know, California Superior Court case in here amongst that, my assumption which is rebuttable by actual fact, is that California law was applied to the non-federal law claims. Of course, it's always possible that there was some other thing, but given that you say the jurisdiction was not contested, and typically if a jurisdiction other than kind of the most obvious one is put in front of the court, there's going to be some mention of a decision on that up or down in the case. Becky Burr says it would have been either California or Virginia law, which is entirely possible given VeriSign as well. So probably should have someone go back to the case to see if there's any recitation of California state law or Virginia law or anything of that that sort there.
I can go back to the case and check.
I see Becky has her hand up, so I'll call on Becky.
Yeah, I just think that ICANN used to put a choice of law in its contract, and, of course, that would have been California. It doesn't do that anymore. But my guess is that the contractual claims, which would have been state law, probably were California at that point. But that's not, that was not man, I mean, that was mandated by ICANN's contracts at the time, which it doesn't do anymore.
Thank you, Becky, and thank you, Matthew. If you could go back and take a look at the case, and, you know, I think I or any of the other of those who suffer from the U.S. legal affliction would be happy to help Kibitz on the question if it's unclear to you what law is actually being applied by the court.
Thanks. Oh, well. Would you put the action item on me, and I'll do a first check and then send out what I find.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions on the VeriSign case in front of us? If not, why don't you go ahead to the second case?
Second is Arizona State, right?
Yeah.
Yes, state of Arizona. That's my personal favorite, obviously, given that it was related to Watchman 1. And it's a quite recent one and a pretty simple one as well because it didn't last long. So the plaintiff was the state of Arizona and a few of the states, actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I have not mentioned them. Maybe because I didn't see them mentioned in the documents. Defendant was NTIA, Department of Commerce, Secretary of Commerce, Assistant Secretary for Communications and Information. And there was an impressive list of amicus curiae in the list, Internet Association, I2C, Internet Society, number of people. Maybe some of you around this core were in this list, including individuals such as Alisa Cooper, Yari, Ted Hardy, Andrew Sargent. When reading the documentation, it's unclear, it wasn't clear to me what ICANN's status was in this case. So that's why I made a note of it. Read the material a couple of times. It wasn't clear to me whether ICANN was actually a party in this and what role it was playing in the process. So that's why I'm putting this note. There were most parties of the case were from the U.S., but not all of them. And there was Jari Arko, who is from Finland, and was a party. I think that's also an important aspect for us to monitor. The court was the U.S. District Court, Southern District of Texas, Galveston Division. I think choice of law was federal law because it was challenging a decision by the federal government, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm learning right what this means. The action was against the INS stewardship transition, with arguing that there was a violation of the property clause of the U.S. Constitution, the First Amendment, as well as the Administrative Procedure Act, violating the INA contract expire. Okay, so the issues were that ICANN might take unilateral actions affecting .gov or even delete it. There would be possible interference in states' property interest from foreign governments and a possible violation of the First Amendment by ICANN. The relief sought was declaratory and injunctive relief. It was not granted. The injunction was denied. Never went further, obviously. And there was a challenge against jurisdiction. The defendants argued that the court, so in Galveston, had no subject matter jurisdiction over the claim. Well, I'm quoting the argument here, which certainly goes way beyond my skill, but at least there was a challenge in the jurisdiction, but obviously that's a challenge against this particular court in the U.S. and not any claim to move the case outside of any federal court, obviously, since these were mostly U.S. parties. There was no impact on ICANN's accountability because transition took place, but obviously if the case had, if the relief had been granted, then we would probably still be discussing Workstream 1 for another 3 or 5 years. So one should say that if it had proceeded, then the accountability mechanisms of ICANN would not be the same. I think that's my summary on this one. Probably some aspects need to be can be clarified, or especially on the choice of law, governing law, and et cetera.
Matthew, this is Greg Shatton. One question with regard to the contested jurisdiction. Did the court come to a decision as to whether this was in the wrong court and should have been in the Court of Federal Claims?
No, there was no mention of that in the decision section, to my knowledge.
Thanks. I guess we can assume to some extent, since the court came to a decision on America,
yes,
more or less, that
yes,
they took jurisdiction over the case and didn't reject it.
Yes.
So implicitly, they continued. They took jurisdiction. And then choice of law, governing law, as you mentioned, there's federal law, and I guess we'll just, you know, need to double check that there was no state law aspect that was cited in the case. Anybody have any questions for Matthew or generally about the case? Well, seeing none, we'll move on to the third case, which is now being posted. Why don't you go ahead, Matthew?
Sorry, I was on mute. So third case is quite complex because this, I mean, this part with ICANN is only a part of a larger case. So that's that the plaintiff is Susan Weinstein from the USA. The defendant is the Islamic Republic of Iran, and ICANN is a garnishee, which I understand is someone brought well, I'll let lawyers explain what that means, but ICANN is part of the of the case, but neither plaintiff or defendant, but certainly would be affected by the decision. And the United States government intervened as an amicus curiae. So quite a political case. So we have parties in the U.S., parties outside of the U.S., obviously, the defendant. The venue is the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. I'll pass on choice of law, governing law for the moment. Probably we can elaborate on that later. It began in June 2014, ended in 2016, September. So basically the case is about an attempt to seize an asset, but the asset is the .ir CCTLD. There's plenty of developments from the defendants about the fact that CCTLDs are not attachable properties and cannot be seized. Plenty of issues with some of the exceptions on federal regulations on this. As I said, it's part of a wider litigation, and this is just the part where the plaintiff is asking for a specific measure seizing the .ir CCTLD. So we don't have all the underlying discussions about the other arguments. There was no preliminary relief requested or granted. The motion for seizing.ir is denied in the end. There was no contest of jurisdiction. And of course, the interest of the case, especially for CCTLD manager like I am, is that it was raising the possibility that to overrule CCTLD policy and operations through a United States court decision. I just quoted, because I found it an excellent summary from one of ICANN's memos, that it would wreak havoc on the DNS system. But it was not granted. And that's my summary.
Thank you, Mathieu. Do we have any questions about this case? Again, we'll need to go back and just check on the governing law issue here. It might be a little more interesting in some cases, given what was the overall subject matter. We have a relatively small group today, so.
Greg, this is Mathieu.
Yeah.
How would you find out about this choice of this governing law aspect in this particular case?
Well, sometimes it's listed in the head notes of the case, depending upon where what report you're looking at. In other cases, it may just be discussed as the case goes along. There'll be mention of particular statutes or laws that are being cited to, or even sometimes the cases that are being cited as precedent. It needs to be, in many cases, teased out of the overall report of the case. Sometimes either where the judge is being nice or where the issue of jurisdiction has been directly contested, there'll be a real discussion, or at least a mention of what
laws being applied. But here in particular, since we're in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, I'll assume almost certainly we're not applying District of Columbia district law to the extent that that even exists for purposes like this. This is, you know, likely a federal question. And sometimes in a federal case, it will say it's a federal question or say what type of jurisdiction it is. And if it is a federal question, then it'll be a federal claim by definition. There can be federal and state claims in the same case, of course. So the short answer is that there is no short answer, and it depends.
Excellent. I just love this.
That's why I'm paying those big student loan bills. I finally stopped. It took a long time. In any case, any questions? I know this is a case that some people have been waiting to hear about. Unfortunately, I don't see some of them on this particular call. We may end up revisiting this case, perhaps after we explore the jurisdiction, you know, governing law question. We may want to come back to this one just so that people feel that it's been fully dealt with. Becky Burr, please go ahead. Becky, you may be on mute. Is anybody hearing Becky? Because I'm not hearing Becky.
Not hearing anything except you, Greg, either.
Sorry, I was on mute, but I didn't have anything important to say.
You can say it anyway if you'd like.
Never mind. I thought better of it.
No problem. In any case, that takes us through these cases. So I don't know if there are any overall comments on these three cases generally, or any comments on how these have been summarized, or whether there are issues. Here, Becky does have something interesting to say, apparently, after all. Becky says there was a long discussion in the cases, the Benhayim case, and its related cases, regarding which attachment law, the state law of attachment, applied in this particular case. Decision there, again, was between D.C. law, which does exist, or California law. Becky, do you recall which way they came out?
I think that they applied D.C. law because that's where the parties were seeking to apply the attachment. And I recall that there was some concern that you'd have a different outcome if it went the other way, but I could be 180 degrees wrong on that.
Thanks, Becky. That's helpful, and I think that points up or highlights the issue of effect of jurisdiction. Now, if, in fact, the application of California law would have given a different result, then the question of jurisdiction, or at least the question of
the host has left the meeting to speak with meeting support and will rejoin soon.
The question of governing law would have been critical, although in this case, interestingly, if they applied D.C. law and not the California law, that shows that California law is not the overwhelming law of all things ICANN. As Becky says, not would have, but potentially could have. So perhaps we should go back and explore that, because I think, and maybe this exposes another, issue of jurisdiction that needs to be explored in these cases, which is whether there's an actual discussion of whether the application of a different law or the law of a different jurisdiction could have potentially had a different result. So that is kind of an effect of jurisdiction here. So I see here that David McCauley says, just getting wind of this discussion. David's having audio issues in Brussels. In the case on screen, I think the court applied D.C. law, which is a tad unusual on attachment. And Becky notes that the plaintiffs sought the attachment in D.C., so the plaintiffs controlled here. And David and Becky seem to be on the same wavelength. We may well come back to this case, you know, just so we can try to highlight the effects of potential different choices of law, or even potentially, to the extent that they were actually discussed in the case. We're not looking for hypotheses about what would have happened if this case had been brought in Kansas or Kuwait, but rather anything that's in the body of the case that discusses the choices of law, choices of venue, the place where the case occurred, or any other related matters. Any other questions on this particular case or comments? Seeing none, let's keep this summary up on the screen for a moment. We don't have any other cases to review, so be able to give you some of your life back. But before we do that, I would like to ask whether, in essence, there's anything missing from this summary. As I mentioned before, you know, perhaps we don't highlight enough whether there was any effect of jurisdiction in the case, and maybe we need a rating scale or some form of a place to highlight the effect of jurisdiction. So in this case, if there was a potential difference between D.C. law and California law, then the effect of having applied D.C. law could have been significant or could have been substantial. And it may also be that the fact that the case was brought in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia and not in another court, for instance, California, also, you know, had an effect. Perhaps it led to the application of D.C. law. Personally, I doubt that in California they would have applied D.C. law, but that really depends more on the reasoning the court used to apply D.C. law. I think there's a need to try to tease out of these cases and perhaps to have a little bit more in the summary, a line or two, a row or two, or kind of try to highlight the effect of jurisdiction question. Matthew, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. I think any assessment of whether the outcome would have been different should a different jurisdiction have been chosen or used, it seems to me it's another type of assessment, because it cannot only be conducted by reviewing the case itself. You need to do some speculations about how it would have turned out in the case where this would have been chosen. So I would probably not go there yet. And focus at the moment on what I find quite interesting is once we find out basically which courts were used in the various litigations ICANN has been facing, we can do statistics and look at the various geographic distribution. Once we find out what type of laws were used in the choice of law section, we can look at what's the most frequent, less frequent, whether there are any challenges, And I think that's all we can do in terms of fact gathering. And then we'll certainly have to go on to more elaborate discussions. But at the moment, I would probably not add too much to that. It's already pretty significant. What we need is to look at the list of cases as a statistical group and see what we can find from there. For instance, it's obvious to me, and just reviewing the list, that there's only one litigation that took place outside of the U.S. It's the pool.com case, and it didn't go very far. I think I sent a form on the pool.com case. At least I've reviewed it, and the form is ready. I don't know if I shared it on the list, actually. So I think that's really what we can achieve as an outcome of this exercise. We start looking at what ICANN is being challenged about, where it's challenged, and whether it's, if we find out the only litigations were with U.S. companies, for instance, that's already useful information. And I would start simple with this before going into legal analysis about what would have happened if other choices had been made. Sorry, I was a bit long. That was my point.
Thank you, Matthew. That was long, but not excessive. I think I agree largely with what you've said. The only point is that if, in fact, the case itself discusses jurisdiction or what might have happened under a different application of a different law, then we should bring it out in the summary. But I agree entirely that, you know, we should not be doing any original legal analysis or hypothesizing, even the best of us or best qualified of us to do that. You know, shouldn't be doing that, at least certainly not at this stage. At this point, we are merely reporting the cases out. So if the case itself does not discuss alternate laws or jurisdictions or outcomes, then that's beyond the scope of this exercise. We just need to make sure to get out of each case every possible bit of information that relates to the multiple layers of jurisdiction so that we can use it, but not go beyond that to independent work and theorizing. We'll have time for that at some point, perhaps if it's necessary or appropriate, but not in reporting the cases themselves. So I thank you, Matthew, for that. I probably went on almost as long as you did and said far less. But in any case, I thank you very much for summarizing each of those cases. And again, if you go back to the case and see if there's anything more direct on the you know, jurisdictional issues, then sure, again, we'll help you know, any of us who, you know, our lawyers can help you back on any of the specifics on the issues. If there's something that you see appears to be relevant but it's not, you can't quite make out what it's trying to say because it's all legalese. And I thank you in advance for the pool case. I'll look forward to that in an upcoming meeting. And I'll encourage all of those who have signed up to analyze cases to complete their analyses so that we can get them out on the list in advance of the next meeting, because if we're only going to listen to Mathieu summarize cases, that's quite unfair to our tri-chair to make him our star performer as well. But thank you, Matthew, again, for volunteering and for being ready to report on each of these cases. Any questions on these cases or any comments on the summary sheet generally, anything you would change about the summary sheet that you don't like, that's missing, that you think is a waste of time or is expressed in a way that you just can't understand it and wish it was said differently? Seeing no other concerns on that,
see if there's a way to tweak it a little bit to bring out the jurisdictional issues. But overall, I think it's a, you know, pretty useful tool. And I see that both David and Aubrey have noted that they will report cases out, and that, you know, David, having already done the two we heard last week, will do more. And so Aubrey and I and others hopefully will have their cases ready for the consideration of the group, and we'll be heading toward the point where we can, as Matthew states, engage in some, you know, statistical analysis or overall view of trends and aggregate data about the case history of ICANN as a litigant. Let's put the agenda back up on the screen, please. Thank you. Here we have it. We are up to all other business. I see a question from Christopher Wilkinson. Will the completed forms be archived on the wiki? They should be. We'll need to make sure that we are getting information ultimately onto the wiki, which is the kind of the permanent repository of information outcome deliverables. You know, we're using for collaborative live documents Google Docs primarily, but the wiki will be the long-term home of all completed work, so we should get those out there. Any other business? Hearing no other business, I'll just check when our meeting is next week. Do we have a meeting scheduled for next week? I'll ask staff. I don't need to have it on my calendar, but perhaps I didn't click on it. Oh yes, we do have a meeting. April 4th, Tuesday. Really, it's Monday night. On my calendar, it's coming up at 1 a.m. U.S. time. Oh, joy. 0500 UTC. I'll be traveling. But able to share this from at 1 a.m. from a hotel room somewhere. In any case, we did say that from time to time we would use the 0500 slot, which is apparently convenient to some people, and they are very important people, and we will make sure that these are convenient times are used for them from time to time. Any questions or comments or concerns? I see Cheryl Langenor briefly came up as having gone off mute, perhaps to remark that she, in fact, is one of those people for whom 0500 is a good time.
I was going to comment, but I won't. It's all right.
Thank you for not commenting, Cheryl. We understand that for every once a month or so that you are, in fact, at a convenient time, there are many, many more times when you are at an inconvenient time, sitting in the dark with your dogs and taking pictures of your feet and engaging fully in the multi-stakeholder process. So we thank you, especially for those who, you know, take on this work that primarily puts them into inconvenient time. Let's all remember that when we grouse about the once a month or every few weeks we have something that falls outside of our sunny times. So I'll stop talking, as I should have about a minute ago. We can, if there's nothing further, we will adjourn this meeting. We can stop the recording, and I thank you all.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, everyone. Bye for now.
Bye, all.